Our next case of the day is number 063713, the United States against Mark A. Samuels. Waschuk.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ann Waschuk, and I represent Mark Samuels, who is the defendant appellant in this case. Mr. Samuels was convicted of aiding and abetting a felon with possession of a gun. The evidence the government presented in his case, however, was insufficient and unfairly prejudicial. Furthermore, the district court improperly sentenced Mr. Samuels by invoking a cross-reference to the aggravated assault guidelines. As a result of the collection of these errors, Mr. Samuels, a man with no criminal history, a wife of over 16 years, and two young children at home, was sentenced to over 6 years in prison. This court held in Heath that aiding and abetting requires proof that the defendant knowingly participated in or intended to aid the principal. The 11th Circuit in Hamblin reversed a verdict for aiding and abetting conviction because the government had presented insufficient evidence with respect to the shared intent.
Ms. Waschuk, the piece of evidence here that I think is most difficult for you to get over is Stevens. I'll use his first name because everybody's got the same name here. Stevens' testimony that he sees Mark hand the gun over to Terry in the van and basically tells him to run away. And the trial court credits this testimony. Now, I recognize in your brief you say, could he have run away that fast and so on. There are different things. But that's a credibility call. And if, in fact, Mark gives Terry the gun, that surely is aiding and abetting a convicted felon of unlawful possession of a firearm. The other elements aren't at issue here.
True. I don't think that the record reflects beyond a reasonable doubt, if that statement is given credibility, that Mr. Samuels, in fact, gave the gun to Terry. There is the statement that Mr. Samuels gave to the police where he said he actually asked for the gun back, which does not reflect any intent to give the gun. Furthermore...
But wait a minute. So you're saying if you give a gun to a convicted felon and then at some later point in time you say, oh, by the way, I'd like it back, that you haven't allowed that felon to have possession of the firearm for a period of time?
No, the statement that Mr. Samuels made to the detective shortly after his arrest does not state that he gave the gun to Terry at any point during the evening. It only indicates that he asked for it back.
But Stephen testifies, though, that he saw Mark hand the gun to Terry.
True, and he also testified that on cross that he saw no such thing at the convenience store. And
no, that's the earlier time. I'm talking about the second time. I know the convenience store testimony is ambiguous. There's the first statement of I saw him hand it, and then he said, well, maybe I didn't see what was handed. I saw something. But then there was the second event, and I thought that the testimony the second time was much more clear, and Stephen says, I saw Mark give Terry the gun. And then they hear him say, run away and get rid of it or whatever. I forget the exact phrase, but something along those lines is said, right?
I think to refute that point, on cross, Stephen was reviewed the statement that he had signed with that he had given to the police shortly after the crime. And in that statement, he had no sense made the claim that he had heard that statement being made at that point in time. Furthermore, as we made in our argument in the brief, based on what Stefan was claiming had happened, occurred up until the point where Mr. Samuels allegedly handed the gun back to, or for the first time, gave it to Terry, the circumstances don't indicate that there was enough time for that to happen, and Stefan provided no explanation for how that could have occurred in the course. Furthermore,
aren't those jury questions, though? I mean, if the jury hears that maybe somebody said something, but then later on at the police department, maybe they're a little less clear, or was there enough time? I mean, surely that's for the jury to resolve, isn't it?
Well, in this case, not only did the jury have to deal with the insufficient evidence that was presented, they also had to deal with the unfairly prejudicial that was presented over the course of the case. So it's our argument that not only did the government present insufficient evidence to support the conviction, that little evidence, when weighed in in consideration with the 3 days of testimony that related primarily to Terry Samuel's conduct, they couldn't have divorced their verdict from Terry's conduct. And as this court held in Ostrowski, where similar events occurred, the government presented evidence of an uncharged crime of murder to help prove an element of the charged offense, which was a felony car theft. And in that case, this court held that the trial was essentially one for murder, when in fact the defendant was charged for something completely different. The same is what we have here. Mr. Samuels was charged with aiding and abetting a felon with possession of a gun. Yet, for the course of 3 days, the jury heard testimony related to Terry's assault and battery of Stefan. They listened to a frantic 911 call placed by Tracy Perkins, which the district court itself noted. She never made any claim as to who possessed the gun during that point in the evening. So when you take that prejudicial evidence, weigh it with the insufficient evidence that the government presented, this case requires a reversal, because the jury was unable to divorce the highly prejudicial evidence relating to Terry's conduct, not even Mr. Samuel's conduct, when it rendered his verdict.
Counsel, suppose the jury had found that the gun was passed to Terry only the second time at the nursing home, no other time. What impact would that have on the government's cross-reference argument with respect to the sentence?
I don't think that it would have any impact on the cross-reference argument with the sentence. I think that the two types of intent that are considered are different. In the cross-reference, it specifically calls for what I believe is the defendant transferred a firearm or ammunition with the knowledge or intent that it would be used or possessed in connection with another offense. So the intent that's discussed with the application of the cross-reference deals with that Mr. Samuels would have had to have intended that Terry would then take that gun and use it in connection with another offense. That intent, I believe, is different than what's required under aiding and abetting, which is that he knowingly participated in or intended to aid the principal. So if that, in fact, statement is true, which we do not concede, I do not think that it would affect the cross-referencing guideline that was applied. And as a result, as this court held in Stromalski, the case should be remanded for resentencing because the facts of intent were not found in order for that cross-reference to be properly applied.
But under that cross-reference, the language you just read, if the defendant used or possessed the firearm in connection with the commission of another offense, surely that might mean Terry. If Terry had the firearm in conjunction with another offense, then the enhancement would be there. And because Mark is an aider and abettor, he steps into Terry's shoes at that point, so he too can be subject to it.
Well, I think that all the relevant conduct of that evening needs to be considered. And in doing so, not just Terry's conduct himself should be used to apply the cross-reference. There's a second line underneath it that says the defendant transferred a firearm or ammunition with the knowledge or intent. That's more appropriate in this case, where our client has been charged with aiding and abetting, that in order for the cross-reference to be applied under an aiding and abetting theory, he would have had to have transferred the firearm with the knowledge or intent that it would be used in connection with another offense, rather than what the district court applied was that the firearm was just used in connection with the commission of the attempted
right.
offense.
Right, and I think it just depends who you think you're talking about by the time you get to 2K2.1C1, when we use the term the defendant, whether we need to work through these guidelines focusing on Terry, the person who commits the substantive offense, and then apply the concept of aiding and abetting, or whether by the time we get over to 2K2.1, the word the defendant means the aider and abettor.
I think under 2K2.1, the word defendant applies to the aider and abettor and not the actions of the principal at that point. The defendant has already been sentenced according to the actions he aided and abetted when it was transferred from the aiding and abetting to the felony gun possession. At that point, I think you need to look at what the defendant himself did and what his relevant conduct was, and which in this case, in order to provide or to in order to properly invoke the cross-reference, you would need to find that the defendant had the knowledge or intent that when transferring the firearm, it would be used or possessed in connection with another offense. And as we stated previously, the government failed to show that Mr. Samuels intended for Terry to have a gun that evening, much less that he intended for the gun to be used in connection with another offense. And as a result of that, this case should be remanded for resentencing. Moving on, the case law also allows the district court to consider acceptance of responsibility and personal characteristics in reducing a defendant's sentence. And the sentencing guidelines permit a two-level reduction under 3E1.1A when the defendant accepts responsibility for his actions. This court in Fiore has held that the sentencing courts should look beyond the formalistic culpability when determining if a defendant has truly accepted responsibility for his actions.
But don't we defer significantly to the district court? And here, the district court finds that Mark's acceptance of responsibility is just too equivocal. I don't see the district court saying it's precluded as a matter of law from doing this. The district court just doesn't have a sense of acceptance of responsibility, if you will. And how can that be an abuse of discretion?
Well, Mr. Samuels attempted to plead guilty before trial, and his first plea was rejected by the court, and then he again attempted to make an Alford plea, which was just a general acceptance of guilt. And had it not been for the government refusing to accept that plea as a matter of their own policy, the case would have been put out at that point in time. I don't think that the district court properly weighed the reason why the Alford plea wasn't accepted
in determining his acceptance
of responsibility.
Yeah. I mean, if the only problem is the judge says, well, you forced a trial, therefore no acceptance, maybe that's one thing. But I think that the court was looking more broadly. I mean, even if the fact of a trial was one thing, I think the judge was worried that Mr. Samuels wasn't saying, yes, you know, I gave him the gun.
Well, that's
he just didn't want to say that, and of course we wind up with these, you know, maybe he doesn't think he did. I don't know, but the jury finds that he did.
I think that goes to the point that that's the main part of our argument, that there was insufficient evidence that the government presented, and over the entire course of the series of events, our client has continued to claim that he did not intend to aid or abet Mr. Samuel or Terry Samuels with possession of the gun. I'm going into my rebuttal time.
Okay.
Thank you, Ms. Boselschuk. We'll hear now from Ms. Scott.
My name is Angela Scott, and I represent the government. I'm from the Southern District of Illinois. I'd like to just address some of the issues raised by the defendant. First, with respect to the insufficiency of the evidence, as the court pointed out, the government introduced evidence of Mr. Samuels' guilt in two manners. One, by showing that he did, in fact, hand Terry Samuels a gun, and we relied on two pieces of evidence. First, that Stephan Perkins testified that he believed that he saw Mark Samuels hand what he believed to be a gun to Terry Samuels on the parking lot of the County Line liquor store. We then asked the jury to draw the inference from that what he actually had given Terry Samuels was the gun because Terry Samuels had that gun on the parking lot.
But, Ms. Scott, you know, I mean, yes, you had these two pieces of evidence, but I have to say I'm very worried with all of this evidence of this beating of Stephen going on, that almost in a 403 sort of sense, this just so overshadows the small bits of evidence that are somewhat problematic of the actual aiding and abetting of the felon in possession of a firearm that, you know, how can you say that this is really what the jury was focusing on?
Well, and, Your Honor, that's what I was trying to explain was, you know, not only did the government prove it in that manner, which the government did not have to prove they handed him the gun directly to prove aiding and abetting, the government had proved that he also created this scenario.
But what's the scenario? You kept saying that in your brief. I had no idea what you meant by the scenario. What, to beat up Stephen? They didn't need a gun to beat up Stephen.
Exactly, Your Honor.
It's irrelevant to that.
And the government disagrees. The government believes, and as it filed in its motion in limine, the evidence of the beating and abduction of Stephon Perkins was necessary to show the jury exactly what happened that night, to show them Mark Samuels' role in this offense.
But what offense? You keep saying that, and I guess what I kept thinking is the offense he's charged with is aiding and abetting a felon in possession of a firearm. And Stephon, if that's how he pronounces it, is beaten up for the most part, not with a firearm. I think the government is blending together a lot of very bad conduct, of course. Nobody would disagree with that. But how this gets to the simple act of Mark giving Terry the gun is remote to me.
Well, Your Honor, as I said in my brief, and the evidence showed at trial, Mark Samuels set these events in motion by initiating this search for Stephon Perkins, by taking his gun and a baseball bat with him, his two brothers, one of who was Terry Samuels, a convicted felon with a violent history.
But why do we think Mark intended to give the gun to Terry instead of keep it himself? He could have kept it himself.
Because, Your Honor, Mark Samuels knew that Terry Samuels had a violent history and that Terry Samuels would help him get this gun back at any way Mark Samuels told him to. Mark Samuels was smart. He was the one that was in charge. He was the ringleader. He recruited Terry.
So which gun are you focusing on? Are you trying to say that the government proves its case by showing that Mark is trying, I would say unsuccessfully, to help get the Glock back? That never happens.
That's correct, Your Honor. That's correct, Your Honor. And that never happened because Stephon Perkins was smart enough to keep the Glock away from them so he wouldn't get killed.
But at least Mark was not aiding and abetting Terry to get the Glock.
But, Your Honor, I believe that you're missing the point here, Your Honor. The point is that the government could show aiding and abetting not only by the fact that he handed him a gun, but by showing his actions. His actions were done that night with the intent and expectation that Terry Samuels would use his gun against Stephon Perkins.
What evidence tends to exclude the possibility that that Mark was just going to keep the gun himself?
Your Honor,
he's such an upstanding citizen, he wouldn't, beat somebody up like that, or what?
I didn't hear the last part of your question.
I don't understand why you think that this whole scenario has to unfold only by Mark giving his gun to Terry.
Your Honor, as we said, as the evidence established at trial, Mark Samuels knew that Terry Samuels would help him get this gun back.
How Terry was going to do it needs to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt with the gun.
Terry
takes
beyond
other things. He beats Stephon up with, everything handy.
Your Honor, the gun that was at issue in this case was Mark's effigy firearm. Glock firearm was only important because that was what Mark was trying to get back when he started all these events in action. So what the government showed was that Mark Samuels gave this gun to Terry Samuels knowing if you look at the evidence, you look at my brief, you see that he riled up his brothers. He brought his brothers with him on a search for one little man. He brought a gun, a bat, and his two brothers. And he says he did that because he was afraid of some violent confrontation. Well, why would there be some violent confrontation, Your Honor, unless Mr. Samuels initiated it? He knew exactly what he did. He ordered them out of the van. He ordered Terry Samuels to lead Stephon Perkins. And all of this is in my brief. All of this is in the trial testimony.
I read your brief. Let me assure you, I always read the briefs in every case.
I believe that you did, Your Honor. But he directed him to lead him around, to hold Stephon Perkins while he searched his car for this gun.
Look, and you have some snippets of evidence that actually connect Mark's gun to Terry. You have the recanted testimony, and maybe the jury can believe one part and disbelieve the other part where they think they see the gun pass. You've got the second incident, which I told your opponent, I think, sounds a little bit firmer to me, where supposedly Mark gives the gun to Terry and says, run away and get rid of it, or whatever he says. Those both strike me as gun-related pieces of evidence. What I'm concerned about is all this other evidence of the 911 tape, the beating, and all the rest of that comes in, and that's not about aiding and abetting a felon to have a firearm. That's just about being a thug. It's about beating somebody up with your fists, with a bat, with anything that's handy. And I don't think that's necessarily about a gun.
Well, and I can tell you, Your Honor, that the government had to prove as part of its case in chief that Terry Samuels knowingly possessed this firearm. And one of the reasons that we gave in our motion in limine for allowing this evidence was to show just that, Your Honor. And the fact was there was evidence that Terry possessed this gun, that he used this gun to batter Stephon Perkins. The evidence of the blood on the gun was brought in to show that the gun that Terry Samuels used that night was the gun that was charged
was
in the
Mark's
indictment,
gun.
Which
yeah.
the government also had to prove, Your Honor.
Let me ask you about another thing on sentencing, because I think we've explored this enough. I'm concerned at the fuzziness of the evidence that allows us to draw the line between serious and permanent injury to Stephon. I don't think there's any doubt that there's a lot of injury, but the sentencing guidelines have different levels that go with, you know, serious, in between, and then permanent. And with nothing but, you know, this isn't like somebody, you know, had their hand chopped off that any lay witness could plainly see happen. This is more subtle evidence of injury. And without medical records or some kind of evidence that would allow us to draw that line, it seems to me the evidence here is very inconclusive.
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully disagree. I believe the district court had plenty of evidence in front of it of the injuries that Mr. Perkins had suffered. I know,
but
that
apparently he changed his story over time. You know, at one point he talks about his kidney, and then we don't really know whether that was his kidney, and he talks about blurry vision, or maybe it's not blurry vision. He talks about a lot of different things.
And, Your Honor, I would note that in the brief where they talk about these inconsistencies, they're talking about the victim impact statement the defendant gave. This was not additional testimony in the injury, so I was not specific with him on, okay, what injuries did you suffer? These were simple victim impact statements given
by
the defendant.
But didn't you need to, though? I mean, since the guidelines ask you to draw this line, you know, how bad are the injuries? Because, of course, it's appropriate to have a more severe sentence the more the injuries. Trying to draw that line between serious injuries and permanent injuries is something that we need some reliable evidence for.
Well, I think that's correct, Your Honor, and I believe the evidence here was reliable.
All we have is Stephon's testimony.
Well, and we have nothing. They offered nothing to refute that at trial that he didn't suffer broken bones, that he didn't suffer failed kidneys, that he wasn't hospitalized for a week.
Was there any medical record?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Any medical records in the hospital?
No, we did not offer any medical records. And part of that was because of the judge's ruling that we had to limit this evidence of the abduction and beating so we couldn't get into the medical injuries that Mr. Perkins had suffered other than what Mr. Perkins testified to about the failed kidneys.
But was the judge's...
Sentencing.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you, sir.
Sentencing either. It wasn't...
No, sir. No.
So the judge would not let you introduce medical records at sentencing?
No, that was not what I was talking about. I'm sorry, and I misunderstood. What I was talking about was at trial we did not offer any medical
records.
Right,
no, I understand
that.
I'm focusing only on sentencing.
No, we did not offer any medical records.
You could have, though.
Yes, I could have, Your Honor, yes. I'd like to address just briefly this argument about acceptance of responsibility. One of the things I think that the judge really looked at here was that Mr. Samuels never truthfully admitted to his role in the offense. He said at his attempted change of plea hearing, well, gee, I guess my gun must have somehow been in my car and Terry must have picked it up and I don't know what happened after that. Well, the evidence showed that that was not true. In fact, when the incident first began, the individuals were in Catrellius Franklin's van. So how Terry could have gotten the gun out of Mark's van and had it that night, I don't know. And that was one of the things that the judge looked at. The implication, the argument that somehow he accepted responsibility by giving a statement afterwards, well, I think that's just ridiculous. If you look at his statement and you look at the lies that he told to the officer during his statement, and you look at how he tried to minimize his criminal conduct, I think that's not truthfully admitting his conduct. And I believe those were the factors the court looked at when he decided, when it decided that he did not deserve an adjustment for acceptance of responsibility. As we pointed out in his request for downward departure, the judge did consider 3553A factors. The judge sentenced Mr. Samuels to the low end of the guideline range, even though the government had requested a sentence at the high end guideline range. And some of the factors I believe the court looked at were that he had no criminal history, which was taken into account in the fact that he was a criminal history category one, and that he had been married. But he was married for over 16 years. He had a long-term employment. He had kids. He had stepkids. But as the government pointed out at sentencing, all of these things were true when he committed the instant offense, when he was the impetus behind this whole incident with Stephon Perkins. And that was what the government established at trial. I don't know if you want me to get into, I think we've charged, with respect to the aggravated assault guidelines, one of the things I want to point out is that the defendant argues with respect to the cross-reference, there's two elements here. It says if the defendant used or possessed any firearm or ammunition in connection with the commission or attempted commission of another offense, or possessed or transferred a firearm or ammunition with knowledge or intent that it would be used or possessed in connection with another offense, then you apply this cross-reference. Well, if you look at the PSR and you look at the district court's holding, you will see that the district court and the probation officer relied on this first prong, that the firearm was used or possessed in connection with the commission or attempted commission of another offense. And even if you want to look at the second prong, I believe the evidence at trial established that it was possessed or transferred with the knowledge or intent that it would be used in connection with another offense. As we point out in our brief, and as the evidence established at trial, Mr. Samuels knew exactly what he was doing that day when he gave that firearm to Terry Samuels, and he did that so that he could get this firearm back from Stephon Perkins. I believe that the evidence was not unfairly prejudicial. I believe that it was necessary to show first that the government had to prove that Terry Samuels committed the offense of being a felon in possession of a firearm in order to convict Mr. Samuels of aiding and abetting that. This evidence was necessary to show Terry Samuels knowing possession of the firearm. This evidence was also necessary to show the jury a complete picture of what occurred that day, of that night, and was also necessary to show Mr. Samuels' role in the offense. And I see my time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Scott. How much time does counsel have? 2 minutes.
I'd like to make two quick points. First is that the government stated that the 911 tape and the blood on the gun were necessary to prove their case of aiding and abetting. But the 911 tape has nothing to do with the intent element that's required. In fact, the district court said you don't even hear who said who had the gun at that point. Secondly, the pictures of the crime scene that have blood all over the car and all over the parking lot also have nothing to do with whether or not a gun's possession was transferred over the course of the evening. I'd also like to address the fact that the government conceded that the first prong was used in sentencing Mr. Samuels. As we discussed earlier, I think that the relevant prong that should have been considered was that Mr. Samuels had the intent when he transferred the firearm that it would be used in connection with another offense. And because the court did not consider that in its sentencing guidelines, the sentence using the cross-reference was an error and should be remanded. In closing, Your Honors, we would like to request that this court enter a judgment of acquittal for Mr. Samuels and, in the alternative, remand for resentencing or for a new trial.
Could I ask one quick question?
Sure.
This is a little bit off the center, but what was it about this Glock gun that caused this, if it's in the record, why he wanted that gun so much? Was he not paid for it? Or is there something? Because they went to all this violent effort to get this gun back from his cousin, whom I thought he sold it to.
I think Mr. Samuels was concerned with the fact that the gun had some criminal history to it, and he didn't want either his cousin or himself to be tied back to that gun or its possession and the criminal history that
was associated with it,
and that's why he
wanted to get it back. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ms. Wasselschuck, you serve by appointment of the court, and the court wants to thank you for your very fine efforts on behalf of your client. We also would like to thank your law firm for devoting the time and resources it did to this very fine representation.
Thank you.
Indeed, our thanks to all counsel in the case, and the case will be taken under advisement.